Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios.
It's Friday, August 28th.
There were at least two dramatic settings to watch people talk from last night. One was the White House, where the convention speeches took place before a large crowd, estimated at more than 1,000 people, that made a show of not socially distancing and in the large majority not wearing masks. The other, speaking as a New Yorker and a Mets fan since I was a kid growing up in Queens, was the mostly empty baseball stadium there, Citi Field. The Mets versus Marlins game, like many scheduled sporting events, did not take place last night. In the Mets' case, somewhat to respect the feelings of one of their young stars, Dominic Smith, one of only two black players on the Mets, very popular with the fans, mostly for his hitting, but also in part because he's known for his upbeat, fan-friendly demeanor. But after Wednesday night's game, Dom Smith was one of those big, tough, strapping athletes who couldn't help but show his human vulnerability.
I think the most difficult part is to see, like, people still don't care. And for this to just continuously happen, I mean, it just shows just the hate in people's heart. And, I mean that just sucks, you know? And being a black man in America is not easy, so... I mean, like I said, you know, I wasn't there today, but I'll bounce back. I'll be fine.
Yes, Tom Hanks, there is crying in baseball when the stakes are higher than a game. So the Mets and Marlins took the field last night in Queens, stood in silence for 42 seconds. 42 was Jackie Robinson's uniform number. Then they tipped their caps to each other and walked back into their dugouts. The camera on the Mets TV channel, SNY, then showed home plate, where a member of the grounds crew had placed a shirt that said, Black Lives Matter. At the Republican convention, one of the things commentators have noticed this week was that nobody would speak Jacob Blake's name, and nobody would speak the words, Black Lives Matter. Well, last night, somebody did say Black Lives Matter. However, it was former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani who said it like this.
So Black Lives Matter and Antifa sprang into action. And in a flash, they hijacked the peaceful protests into vicious, brutal riots.
Take that, Dominic Smith from the New York Mets. Maybe it was because Rudy is a well-known Yankees fan. Or maybe it was deeper than that. Speaking before Rudy, his ally, the New York City Police Union Chief Pat Lynch, did not say the words Black Lives Matter, but he framed the protest movement like this.
The violence and chaos we're seeing now isn't a side effect. It isn't an unintended consequence. It's actually the goal.
One of the big contradictions of the convention was the framing of the protest movement in ways like those, while featuring many black speakers to make the case that President Trump is not a racist and really cares what happens to them. One of those speakers last night was Trump's Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson, who said the cries of racism generally, well, he characterized it like this.
My mother always told me, Ben, you can do anything, but I will never allow you to become a victim. It was then that I stopped listening to the people who were trying to convince me that I was a victim and that others were responsible for my victimhood.
Secretary Carson did, however, single out one thing happening in this country that he calls racist.
What is racist is the fact that African Americans have the highest abortion rate.
The president's daughter, Ivanka, also spoke last night. Remember when Trump was first elected and there was a lot of talk that Ivanka would keep her distance, politically speaking? If that idea wasn't put to rest before, it certainly was last night.
Tonight, I stand before you as the proud daughter of the people's president.
And remember when the talk was that being a politically moderate person, Ivanka would influence her father to move him to the center? Well, she kind of admitted last night it has actually worked the other way.
He is so unapologetic about his beliefs that he has caused me and countless Americans to take a hard look at our own convictions and ask ourselves, what do we stand for?
Note to the Washington Press Corps, ask Ivanka when you get a chance what she meant by that, how what she stands for during these last 4 years has changed. As for the president's speech, a lot of the commentary this morning is about how hard he went after Joe Biden and the Democrats. And yes, we've been hearing the argument all week that the Democrats will give us crime and economic decline. No surprise there that the president continued that. We've heard it already today here in some of the clips we've already played. And Republicans always argue that. But to me, the heart of the speech was the very long time that the president spent making the case that he has kept his promises on policy. Now, if some people say this is a post-policy election, if you heard that term, I'm not so sure. Trump and Biden disagree on so many policies, we could cover 30 issues in 30 days in the month leading up to the election and not run out. Here are just some of the examples from last night where the president said he kept his policy promises.
We shocked the Washington establishment and withdrew from the last administration's job-killing Trans-Pacific Partnership. I then immediately approved the Keystone XL and Dakota Access Pipelines. Ended the unfair and very costly Paris Climate Accord.
And
we passed record-setting tax and regulation cuts at a rate nobody had ever seen before.
And
in perhaps no area did the Washington special interests try harder to stop us than on my policy of pro-American immigration. But I refuse to back down.
And there were many more. Maybe this will be a post-policy election and a high-stakes policy election at the same time. With me now, three guests. Juan Williams, co-host of The Five on Fox News Channel, a former NPR host and author of the book, What the Hell Have You Got to Lose? Trump's War on Civil Rights. Charlie Sykes, for 23 years a conservative talk show host in Milwaukee, now co-founder and editor-at-large at The Bulwark, a mostly conservative but mostly anti-Trump news organization, and author of the 2017 book, How the Right Lost Its Mind, in addition to earlier books such as A Nation of Victims, A Nation of Moochers, and Dumbing Down Our Kids. And Rebecca Heinrichs, a national security expert at the mostly conservative Hudson Institute, an adjunct professor at the Institute of World Politics, and a contributing editor for Providence, a journal of Christianity and American foreign policy. Juan and Charlie, welcome back. Rebecca, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to start by getting all of your thoughts on the juxtaposition this week of the events in Wisconsin and the sports world after the shooting of Jacob Blake and what we saw at the Republican convention. Charlie, as the Wisconsinite among us, would you go first and tell us your own reactions in human or policy terms, either, both, as well as what you think the political ramifications are for the presidential race?
Well, yes. The situation here is fluid. And what really strikes me is how polarized the reaction has been, both to the police shooting of Jacob Blake seven times in the back and the shooting deaths of two individuals by a 17-year-old militia member. This is one of those moments where you see how tribal everything has become. So people have asked me, well, you know, is this playing into Donald Trump's hands? My honest answer is I don't know right now. The scenes of rioting, of burning in Kenosha, clearly are sparking a backlash. Clearly, the polls would suggest that support for Black Lives Matter has declined. But I think the sort of chaos that we're seeing when you have militia members coming in to the community, crossing state lines and killing people. I think that's a big question mark in my mind. And I will say, one of the juxtapositions that I can't get out of my head is the way at the Republican National Convention they highlighted and lionized this this white couple from St. Louis who came out brandishing weapons, pointing them at black protesters. And the juxtaposition of that with this young 17-year-old in Kenosha who decided that he was also going to engage in vigilante action and comes into a volatile situation, leaves two people dead. You know, this is a moment of real tension and I think a real danger for both political parties at the moment.
Juan Williams, same question I asked to Charlie, your reactions and your political analysis of it.
Well, I think we start with the speech last night, Brian, and I thought the speech was a little flat. You know, I was thinking it really was going to match the fireworks in the sky, which I don't know if you saw it, but they were spectacular over the White House last night. They even were able to spell out TRUMP 2020. Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the speech itself did not live up to the billing, not full of surprises, and even the effort to really make the case that this should not be a referendum election on President Trump, but a binary choice between Trump and Biden, and here is why you shouldn't vote for Biden. I mean, at some point he said Biden's weak. Obviously, as you articulated, he went after Biden, socialist tendencies, the country will go to hell and all that. But I thought there was going to be some higher octave that was going to be hit last night, and it just, didn't happen. The setting was spectacular and all. But to pick up on what Charlie was saying, it's striking the dissonance between the convention, especially the Republican convention, and the reality in the world at this moment. It's not only Dominic Smith of the Mets, crying. I think that there's a strong sense that the virus is still very real. I think there's economic instability with unemployment climbing and, of course, the racial tension. And, the president mentioned Jacob Blake. He didn't mention Kyle Rittenhouse, the 17-year-old militia man. Never said a word about Black Lives Matter. And a lot of it, it seemed to me, is in a sphere where you would say it's the Trump show and it's in reruns. And maybe the speech came off as lacking anything punchy because we've heard much of it before.
Rebecca Heinrichs, I know your expertise is mostly foreign policy, but do you want to weigh on this in on this too?
I would like to. Thanks for the opportunity. Yeah, I would just say, I think internal polling is probably showing that that the unrest in the streets and especially in Kenosha are something that the Democrats have to speak more directly to, which is why you had Vice President Biden come out with a recorded statement saying that the protests and the riots, or that at least the riots and the violence, has to stop. That underneath all of this unrest is real pain and real frustration that the country has to grapple with. But before we can do that, you got to go back to your houses and you got to get out of the streets. And we just haven't seen that kind of statement as directly as the vice president gave it. And I think that that's going to have to be even more elevated. It's Kamala Harris recently, it was days ago, but she had essentially given support to what was going on in the streets and saying that it isn't going to stop and it shouldn't stop because this is a long time coming. And I think that that message is going to have to change. Having said on that, on the Republican side, I've grown up in Republican politics and watched the issue of race kind of unfold and have long been frustrated that Republicans, conservatives aren't better at speaking directly to Black Americans and welcoming them into the party and giving them reason to join the party and trying to establish trust. And what I was struck by was the direct appeal to Black Americans that was a constant theme. It wasn't just like a one thing that was mentioned on day one. I mean, you constantly saw Black elected officials, obviously Senator Scott, but then I also thought was incredibly impressive, Attorney General Daniel Cameron from Kentucky. talking specifically to Black Americans and making an appeal. So I thought that that was a very good thing. And then giving specific solutions, Senator Tim Scott in particular, talking to Black Americans on what we can do to address some of these issues, was a very fruitful thing. And so I was very impressed by that sustained theme. And you know, I think that you know, we need both. We need law and order, and we do need to address these issues so that Black Americans can feel and sense and actually have a greater sense of equal justice under the law.
Juan, why don't we react to that?
Sure. I mean, I too noticed the strong number of Black people, specifically older Black men, who had a role in the Republican convention. And it was striking, as Rebecca says. Now, it was striking to me because I think the audience for this convention is specifically, in political terms, suburban white women, who at the moment have turned away from the president. They are a large cohort of the groups right now that have given Joe Biden a lead in the national polls and in the swing states. And I think part of that, you know, discontent on the part of those suburbanites is that they feel the president is divisive and is specific, divisive when it comes to a lot of his racial rhetoric and behavior. So I think that the convention made an effort to speak to this and to say the president is not the person that you think he is based on the first-term record, that in fact he is someone who can show empathy, he can be nice, he can help people. He pardoned that woman who spoke last night who was in jail on a nonviolent drug crime. He even pardoned a bank robber doing it, another Black person, during the course of the convention at the White House. So I think that in large part it was a message to people that the president is not racist, or don't, you know, ignore all you've heard before or thought before, because I think in the polls it's like more than 50% of Americans think the president is a racist.
Yeah.
But there was a secondary audience to pick up on Rebecca's point, which is I think that the Trump campaign, again, based on what I saw, must think that they can do something with Black men. I think it's they got only 4% of the Black female vote last time, but about 13% of the Black male vote, Brian. And maybe they think that there's an opportunity here to, if not capture those votes, at least persuade those people not to come out and vote. The president recently said in a tape that was released that he really appreciated Black people who didn't vote in 2016, that it was critical in big cities like Milwaukee, like Philadelphia, like Detroit, and the difference that allowed him to capture the Electoral College.
Charlie, he name-checked Milwaukee. That puts you on the mic.
Yeah, just a couple of things. Joe, just a little bit misleading about Joe Biden's comments about the violence. He did make a taped comment about it, but then he also did it live twice yesterday. So did Kamala Harris. So that is in fact new. And I think he was very clear about it back in May as well. But I also agree that he's got to be more vocal about it. But I mean, I'm sorry, guys. You have to have a reality check. This convention was a lot of gaslighting. You know, it is one thing to, you know, watch the press. Here's the context. The context is actual the character and the policies of Donald Trump. The president is a racist who is pursuing racist policies, who is running for reelection by fomenting racial division. The fact that you put on a made-for-television production, an infomercial, in which you pretend that the reality is that the reality that you've seen and we're experiencing is not real, shouldn't actually distract from that fundamental fact. So, you step back and you think about what's actually happening in this country, the way in which the president is pouring gasoline on the racial divisions, the way in which he is pitting Black versus white, the way that he has run for office trying to foment a distrust and dislike of immigrants. Please do not tell me that in the last 4 days somehow the Republican Party has found its compass or has come back, because the dissonance between who Donald Trump is and what Donald Trump is doing and what the Republican Party has enabled and the show they put on is pretty dramatic.
Gary in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Gary.
Come on.
You're on.
Hey, how's it going? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear fine.
Great. I just thought I'd watch both weeks of all the conventions. And it's just really interesting to me because on the one side, you have Trump obviously gaslighting, saying that there's no real worry about the virus. And don't worry about that. This is the real concern. And vice versa, on the Democratic side, you have them saying there's no street violence, there's no riots. Don't worry. But both sides don't seem to recognize that other people have a completely different reality that they're living in. And when I live in Brooklyn, and we all know that police shootings over the past decade are down tremendously. So if you say, you point that out, people say, no, police are still the real problem. But then if you look at the murder rate, obviously it's going up a little bit, but it's still down from historic lows. So both things are actually getting better. But if you look at one side, it's all, no, the police are a huge threat. And if you look at the other side, it's no, crime is rising at an unprecedented level. So it's really hard to get a clear picture of the reality when both sides are blatantly distorting statistics that show both things are actually going down tremendously.
The last complex thinker in America. So where do you come down for yourself, Gary, after all of that and trying to synthesize it into a reality that's real as you see it?
Well, I work in criminal justice and I also studied economics in undergrad. So I just look at the data and I realize they're both trying to manipulate us emotionally to make us be afraid, either of one thing or the other, when in reality we have to just look and see most police are good, but also crime is still at almost historic lows, and you can't really trust either of these parties, which is why I'm a libertarian.
Gary, thank you very much for your call. He mentioned the virus, and Rebecca Heinrichs, I was looking over some of your clips from this year, and I saw that you wrote on the conservative site, The Federalist, way back when the pandemic was first getting bad here, beginning on March 19th, that was the publication date for this, we can do a better job of calmly and graciously communicating to our friends and family members that we must take this matter deadly seriously for ourselves and our neighbors. Reject the caricature of the American rugged individualist who relishes in rejecting wise counsel. It is not un-American to heed wisdom, to look outward toward the well-being of our community. Quite the opposite, in fact. So has President Trump calmly and graciously communicated taking this matter deadly seriously, or as you advised, rejected the caricature of the American rugged individualist who relishes his rejecting wise counsel?
So I would say a couple points on that. One, I have been the one area where I think President Trump has had the hardest time on this is right in the beginning of the pandemic, when his policies were to restrict travel from China and doing all these other things, that his rhetoric still didn't meet the gravity of what was happening. The pandemic was beginning to hit the United States really hard. And at the time, we didn't know how bad this novel virus was. We had very little information. We were still trying to get information from the WHO and from the Chinese, which we still haven't received all of the information we need to be able to evaluate the virus. So I think that was definitely a misstep on the part of the president at that time. Now, as we've had more data, I mean, this is a virus that the news is changing. The data is coming in. We're getting more information from the Europeans as they open schools and that kind of thing. We have learned that it is thankfully less deadly than we thought it was, although it's still very highly contagious. It still doesn't seem to impact children. So we have new information.
I can't let that stand.
Exactly.
It does impact children, but I understand that there are lesser effects on children. There are obviously these big debates all over America about how much of a risk it is that they're going to spread it to their older family members. But go ahead, Rebecca.
Yes, certainly. I'm a mother of five. And so this is obviously an issue that I'm tracking very, very closely in concern for all of my children as they go back to school. So I am tracking the data and watching and seeing how it not only just affects my children directly, but how they can be vectors into the larger society. But the point I was making in that piece, though, too, was that, listen, if we don't want the government mandating things and telling us what we can and cannot do, then we as individuals need to be responsible and look out for our neighbor and wear our masks and wash our hands and, you know, follow instructions. And that was what I was trying to urge Americans kind of earlier on, that was a wise thing to do in a self-governing society. But do I think that we're there yet? No, I think that's an area that we have really fallen down on, especially among conservatives, this idea that masks now have become so political, you know, political that it's like a sense, you know, it's a sign of don't tread on me to not wear a mask. And I think that that's a problem. On the other side, people have also had sort of a religious reaction and have come down really hard on people who, for a variety of reasons, are not wearing a mask in particular situations. And so, you know, I wish we were better at this because I think we're going to have to settle in and deal with this virus for a long time. I don't think it's going to be going anywhere.
Rebecca Heinrichs, national security expert at the Hudson Institute, Charlie Sykes, editor-at-large at The Bulwark, and Juan Williams, co-host of The Five on Fox News Channel. Thank you, thank you, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.